Well, it bothers me a little bit that it took God 13 weeks to write this and took me 19 so far to cover it. But I think I'm not going to get through a chapter 12 tonight. So we got this chapter and then 13. I'd like you to take your notes and look at the opening page. I don't often comment on this, but I want to remind you about these paragraph divisions and why I put these in here. On the far left is the American Bible Society's latest edition of the Greek New Testament. It's paragraphing. And then New King James, which is a word for word, New Revised Standard, a word for word. Today's English Version and the New Jerusalem Bible are called dynamic equivalent translations. Now, the whole point is, if you were a Bible teacher, I'm going to cover 1 through 12, through 13 tonight. The question would be, how many major truths are there? If I was going to outline a sermon, if I wanted to make sure I get the high point, how many major truths? Well, if you'll look across, most of these are going to say there are 3 major truths. The last one's going to say there's just 2. Well, this is what you've got to pray about and ask yourself, because paragraphing is not inspired. I know that's pitiful, but it's not. So we're saying, what is the unified theme that holds 12 together? Now, I'd say to you, there's no way to understand 12 unless what? You read 11. Particularly verse 40. Because it's going to say that all of this, in 39, all of these didn't receive what was promised. They looked forward to it. They died looking for it, but they didn't receive it. And in verse 40, somehow the believers of all the ages are going to be together. And so, because of this roll call of faith, chapter 12 is going to say something to us. I love this text. I preach on this a lot. I don't think I've preached on this here, but I titled these first few verses, The Christian Athlete, which I think is uniquely relevant to Winter Olympic time. I hope you've been watching that on TV. It's so exciting to watch those athletes. I remember, I think it was Peggy Fleming. Remember that ice skater named Peggy Fleming? They asked her one time, said, how long have you been skating? She said, I've been practicing 5 hours a day since I was 5 years old. To win a crown that will not last. Now, do you hear what God is saying to Christians on that other side? We have a crown that will not fade, and we don't spend anywhere near 5 hours a day since we're 5 years old, praying, studying, sharing. And a Christian athlete's a powerful metaphor. That's why Paul uses, you know, I don't know, I always get ticked when people say, oh, these New Testament writers, they're so... Well, they're just not real men's men. I won't tell you, I think Paul snuck off, went to those Greek Olympic things. They're all nude. That would have been attractive. But he uses this imagery from wrestling and racing and boxing. Now, he got that imagery from somewhere. It's either athletic or military. Some of it has to be athletics. Some of it can be military athletic. But I think Paul was a sports person. I know he would have rooted for the Saints. Somebody asked me who I was for last week. I said, well, I am for the Saints, but I think it's hard for a Baptist preacher to be for a group that's going to cause 50,000 people to get drunk and fall down the street in New Orleans. These are athletic metaphors. Now, the other metaphor that's here, and I'm gonna go through verse 13. The other metaphor that I think may be the best a metaphor for communicating Christianity. Now, I think there are two of them. One is the marriage metaphor. Now, Peggy and I married when we were 22. I knew her and married her within 5 months. Holy moly. Nobody told me women had cold feet. And nobody told me that when you say richer for poorer, sickness, they think you mean they can get their feet warm on your back. Now, first thing we bought was booties at my house. But I promised to love this woman and be with her and care for her till we die. Now, when I trusted Jesus Christ as a child, I did not know all that involved about living the Christian life for Him. But the more I know, the more I've come to fulfill that role and appreciate that role. So I think marriage is a really good analogy. And the corollary to that is in here, and that is parent-child. Parent-child. Now, we're going to do the God is Father and He's disciplining us, and we think discipline's bad, but I don't discipline your children. I don't holler at your children when the danger comes. The fact that I'm somewhat careful and sometimes spank them is not because I hate them. It's because I love them. I still remember my, do y'all remember the thing called a big wheel? And my daughter, when she was little, she had to have a big wheel. And so she'd run down our driveway and across the street and up the neighbor's drive. But I lived on a street that went to the mall. And you, this little girl, you're trying to say, honey, that cars can't see you. You can't get in the street. Don't do it. Think that stopped her?
No.
So you try to explain, little girl, big car. No, she ain't getting it. So I said to her, if you go in the street again, I'm going to spank you. And you're not going to remember it. I can still remember Peggy coming out of the house and saying to me, oh, Bob, you're going to leave a mark on her. You're exactly right. Because I'd rather her be marked and alive than dead. Now, that's what my daddy says to me sometimes. Son, this will kill you, destroy your ministry, hurt my kingdom. I ain't going to let you go that way. And that took me forever to understand that. I thought God was the cosmic killjoy. It was a time in my life I thought God was against Baskin Robbins. I mean, you know, if it feels good, God's against it. That was my view. It came from a Baptist church. But that's not God's view. Amen? He is disciplining us for our good and His purposes, just as a loving parent. So I think the Christian athlete and a loving parent are two really powerful metaphors that communicate to our day. And they're both right here. Let's work through the notes if we could. Therefore, now friends, this is a unique therefore, but whether it's unique or not, you know, this particular form only appears here and one other time. But when you read this, think about these connectors. Because of, therefore, on account of, yet, but. These are major connectors for our thinking through these texts on larger than verses. I want to remind you, we are terribly guilty of atomizing scripture into very small pieces that we can twist into what we're comfortable with. And what we need is to hear these inspired authors speak. And we've got to link this up. So you can't really understand 12 unless you know what 11's all about. Therefore, now this great a cloud of witness is who? Now this is metaphorical. This is a common Greek idiom for a large group of people. We're talking about the people of chapter 11. I do not believe, now think with me a minute, some people have said to me, yes, your mother's in heaven watching you. I do not want my mother watching me. I'm embarrassed about some of the dumb things I still do. Mama, I'm glad you're there. Close the window. I do not think our loved ones watch our lives. This is really talking not that they're in a great stadium watching us, but that we look to so great a cloud of witness and emulate their life. You hear what I'm saying to you? So this is not they're watching us. We need to look at them. We need to watch them. They have set the pattern. They have set the stage, and we need to look to them. So great a cloud of witnesses. Now the word witnesses, we get the word martyr from this in English, of course, and there's several different definitions. Words, I scream this all the time. I hope you hear. Words only have meaning in context. You cannot go to a dictionary for word meaning. Dictionaries only list how that word has been used in different contexts. That's what that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is all about. You can't tell the meaning till you see the context. Now, this word can mean a legal witness. It can mean, if you see my notes there, it can also refer to someone who tells what they have seen and heard, or in a courtroom witness, or it can refer, and I think that's exactly what it's doing here, to those who died for the faith in chapter 11. There's the other word for witness. Now, remember the context. Here's where the big picture comes in. Here's where the knowledge of the purpose of the whole book. Remember the first time, the first way to do Bible study is read the whole book in one sitting and say to yourself, what's the overall purpose of the whole book, right? And then you go to the parts. The whole book is Jewish believers and Jewish unbelievers worshiping in a synagogue setting. The Jewish believers will not fully accept Christ, and the believers are thinking about going back to Judaism. Now, in that light, this this starts making sense. This, you start seeing the big picture. So we encourage them. Don't shrink back. Don't give up. Look at the past. Now look at these Old Testament examples of faith. And you believers, hang in there and don't grow weary in well-doing. It's interesting to me, this little verb, lay aside. Now, lay aside, that would mean lay aside a piece of clothing, okay? I guess it's Paul that first caught my eye on this in Colossians and Ephesians and other places when he says, strip off and put on. Now, I think Paul may be going back. Paul's, of course, Old Testament rabbi type. I think he's going back to Zechariah, where the high priest Joshua has dirty clothes. And the Lord wraps him in clean high priest clothing. So clothing becomes a metaphor. You strip off the old and you put on the new. So Paul uses this in an ethical sense. Now this is an athletic sense. Now, a little metaphor I like to use in my sermons. If this doesn't happen in the winter games, but in the summer games, if you're getting ready for the 100-yard dash, would you be surprised to see a sumo wrestler there? Now, if you're in a sumo wrestling match, you'd be surprised to see skinny mini too, right? No, athletes train by putting weights on their bodies. You know that? Ankle weights, arm weights. They train to get ready with weights. But when it comes time for the race, they take those weights off. Those weights are meant to what? Develop the muscles, improve the time, improve the score. What he's saying with us is we're entangled. We got too much weight on us. Now, I want to tell you a story, and I don't know you well enough, so if I offend you, please forgive me. I had a deacon at my church in Lubbock. That's just a wonderful man. But he must have spent 30 hours a week manicuring his lawn. A week after he was dead, you'd never know he was alive. That lawn went back to nothing. He spent an inordinate amount of time on something that was not sinful, something that was appropriate, but it was overdone and it became the most important thing in his life. You hear what I'm saying to you? Sometimes the good, listen to me, the good can rob us of the best. It took me forever in my life. I think I have two gifts and I never know which one to use. But what would happen in my life, people would ask me to do this and do that. It's a compliment and go here. And I would say yes. And finally, I realized that I was diluting my call in ministry by trying to do too many good things and robbing others who were gifted in that area of the opportunity to do it. No is a spiritual answer. And if you've got 50 things in church, you need to divest yourself and let some other Christians participate. You ain't that hot anyway. If we take God's calling and dilute it with other even appropriate things, I believe we're out of the will of God. So now this word, lay aside every encumbrance. This is the word for weight. This is the athletic metaphor here. And I think we got to be careful of what we spend our time. I got a call to do a Bible study later this year at a little bitty Baptist church in Shreveport. And I'm going to do it because I told God, if you will help me understand this, I will share it every place that you invite me. But the older I get, the harder it's me to say, Bob, should I focus on coming to Dallas and preaching for you? Or should I focus on writing commentaries for the world? God help me. First of all, I would be miserable if I didn't get to preach. But the truth is, if I can reach 50,000 online, I can't spend all my energy on reaching 150. There comes a time we got to prioritize the gift and calling of God. What has God called you to do? Are you doing it? Now, there's the Holy Spirit's question tonight. Good things often rob us of God's best, God's gift. So take off this weight. Now, if you notice in my notes, this little phrase, the New American Standard, which so easily entangles up. If you notice the first note, one of these very early papyrus manuscripts, it's the Chester Beatty Papyri called P46, which is Paul's part, says easily distracts. Now, I used to believe, and boy, textual criticism is a, it's just difficult. You used to think if it's older, it's got to be closer to the original. Well, that's true about time, but that's not true about the better text. Because what happened with these writings, a church would get this writing, and they'd be so thrilled to have the writing of a Christian leader that some would copy it quickly to save when the manuscript moved on. Well, if that person who copied it quickly was not a professional scribe or a well-educated person, that copy is not as good as the one that passed on. And much of the papyri manuscripts, though they're older than everything else, are not the better one. But this one fits so perfectly in the context, right? So easily distracts. That's the issue. We can't become the sumo wrestler running the 100-yard dash for God, even with the best motives. I hope you understand what I'm saying. Now, this emphasis on run here, I think that's the athletic metaphor. There's so many. The note at the bottom of the page, the set before us, I've listed Paul's athletic places, his athletic context there in 1 Corinthians 9, Philippians 1, his racing metaphors, his boxing metaphors, and his wrestling metaphors, which could be hand-to-hand combat in Ephesians 6 or wrestling. But here we're using athletic metaphors. If Peggy Fleming can spend 5 hours a day since she's 5 years old and now she's 23... to win a crown that fades, what is the matter with us? We have eternal life at our disposal, and we refuse to share it and live it for whatever reason. And I'm not saying we're caught up in sin and out doing terrible things. I just want you to know, have you structured your life where the best for God is what you're doing? And many of us have to say, no. Other things have entered in and taken the priority. Good things. And we've got to come back and rethink this now. We've got to come back and rethink it. Fixing our eyes on Jesus. Now, I used to get ticked. You ever watch Muhammad Ali box? Sometimes he would look at the crowd. Do you know that? You ever watch him? He'd do that shuffle and look at the crowd, watch this. And friends, you don't do that if you're in a 100-yard dash. No runner can look at mommy and daddy and win that race. Your eyes are focused on that finish line. Now, what this is saying is, and we're mixed metaphors here. One is, keep your eyes on the witnesses. That's the great cloud. But the other one is, you keep your eyes on Jesus. You keep your eyes on the finish line. You keep your eyes on the purpose. You keep focused on what you're called to do. That's a good word for us. We're to look at Him. Keep focused. And then it uses these metaphors for Jesus, the author and perfecter. Now, the first term here was used in chapter 2, verse 10, where Jesus is called the author of our salvation, the one that brings it, the one that provides it, that kind of. The second one is a word that means to complete or make perfect. And, of course, I think we're talking about the redemptive task that God gave Jesus that he perfectly fulfilled. It is interesting to me, as you start looking at the number of times that this particular author, and I don't think it was Paul, I don't know who it was, but look at the number of times this author used the word perfecting. 2:10, 5:9, 6:1, 7:11, 7:19, 7:28, 9:9, 10:1, 10:14, 11:40, and here. This author had a goal-oriented, teleological view of life. I think we live religious lives. I think we're conscious of outward terrible sins. But I think we drift on the current of culture without grasping the moment for God. We just float through life. Every day is just I promise you there are divine encounters that will come across your life tomorrow that will never come across again if you don't have spiritual eyes to see. Today is not like tomorrow. Opportunities once missed are missed. You and I have got to focus on who we are and why we're still here. Now, the word faith is interesting. This, of course, is the word pistis. This word has three possible orientations. It can mean faith in Christ. It can mean, Old Testament sense, faithfulness to Christ, Christ-likeness. Or it can mean, usually the definite article, the faith, the gospel, Christian truth, once and for all given to the saints. That's twice in Jude. I like to put it this way. I believe the gospel. Now think what I'm saying is, I'm going to combine all three of those in one. I believe the gospel is a person to be received, welcomed. It's a personal relationship. Truths about that person to be believed. That's an affirmation of the trustworthiness of Scripture. And third, a life like that person to be lived. Now, what Baptists are forever asking me is, which one can I leave out and still go to heaven when I die? That's the unfocused life. That's losing sight of who we are, that we're gifted, that we're here for a purpose, that we can do things with effect that others cannot do. Have you sat down? You think, you know, in college, kids just ask you two things. Who am I going to marry? I go crazy on that one. And the other one is, what am I supposed to do? What's the will of God for my life? Well, you can't answer either one of them for anybody. But I say to them, if I could put you in a room, it was quiet, you could think, you could pray. If time wasn't the big deal, money wasn't the big deal, education wasn't the big deal, what would you like to do for God? And they start telling me. And then I start saying, you know, the Psalms promises that he'll give us the desires of our heart. That may be the will of God for your life. Now, come on. May I say to you again that everybody in this room that's saved is a called, gifted, full-time minister of Jesus Christ? Now, I want to ask you, what are you doing for the kingdom? I don't care where you work. I don't care what your vocation is. I want to ask you, what is the teleological, purposeful will of God for your life for the kingdom? And if you can't answer that, this chapter is for you. We may be running really fast. It's like Peggy says, boy, they're going fast. Well, they're going fast. They don't know where they're going. How many of us speed don't know where we're going? That's American culture. We're all going much too fast, but we do not know where we're going. For the joy set before him. Now, this sounds like to me, and I want to read it real quick. This sounds like to me, for the joy set before him endured the cross. This sounds like a reference to Isaiah 53 to me. Listen to this. And this, of course, the great substitutionary atonement text, the suffering servant part of Isaiah. I'm going to pick up at 53:10. But the Lord, this is Yahweh, was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he, now that's talking about the Messiah there, if he would render himself as a guilt offering, he, Messiah, would see his offspring. He will prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord, Yahweh, will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. Now, I guarantee you the cross was no fun. You read Gethsemane lately? Three times Jesus said, let me out. But he went through it because he looked through time and saw the effect. Friends, you are a special person in the lives of your sphere of influence that nobody else can penetrate for the kingdom as you can penetrate. Nobody. Irregardless of education, calling, potential, you have the ear of people. You're here not by accident. Got to remember who we are and why we're here. Set before him, I marked my notes so I could read this if you let me. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. This word, set before him, occurs in verse 1, referring to the struggle or race of the Christian life. Now the term is used again of the struggle of Jesus in laying down his life for us. This is the author's way of urging the Jewish believers to persevere. Jesus did his part, they must do theirs. When he finished, there was great joy. So too, if they finish the race. Don't you remember Paul where he says, I've run the race, I've finished the course, they're laid up for me a crown of righteousness. Brothers and sisters, when your day comes to meet him, I hope that's a similar experience for you. But now's the time to claim that. Not deathbed. With energy and opportunity, now's the time. Now's the time to claim that. The word cross here, I made a note. I think the word cross is very interesting. In the Old Testament, this idea of hung on a tree is not, of course, Roman or really Phoenician crucifixion. In the Old Testament, to be improperly buried affected your afterlife. So the most horrible thing you could do to a Jewish person is not kill them, but improperly bury him. Remember when they hung Saul from the gate of the city and his friends had to come get him? Well, they would take somebody already dead and impale them on a stake for the birds to eat. Now, that's originally what these Old Testament quotes. And the one that I think is so powerful is this Deuteronomy 21:23. Now, this is where it says, "Cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree." Now, that didn't refer to crucifixion. That refers to impaling. But the Jews of Jesus' day, because particularly Herod, not only Romans, but Herod, you know, he was so upset that nobody would grieve for him, Herod the Great, when he died. He had 1,000 Pharisees imprisoned to crucify the day he died so that Israel would weep. That was a crazy brother. They knew what crucifixion was. This had become, it's an Old Testament metaphor for a New Testament reality for these rabbis. Now, why do you think when they went to Pilate to get Jesus killed? Now, follow with me. Why did they accused him of blasphemy, right? Calling himself equal with God. The Old Testament requirement for blasphemy is stoning. Now, why didn't they stone him? Because they're afraid of the crowd. Well, people have said to me, well, the Romans didn't let the Jews have the power of capital punishment. Well, what about Stephen? He ticked them off, and they drug him outside the temple and stoned him on the spot and didn't ask the Romans to kiss their foot about it. Why not do the same to Jesus? These rabbis, they want this upstart Messiah cursed by God. Cursed is he who hangs on a tree. They want this upstart to be proven to be an upstart by having him crucified and this Deuteronomy curse come in. Now, I used to bother me. I think it bothered Paul. But you know, in Galatians 3:13, in this famous text, you'll link this up, he became the curse for us. Bore the curse of the law. So this idea of a cross is a penetrating theological connection between Deuteronomy and Galatians 3. Set down. Do you recognize this set down as a quote from Psalm 110? Now, how often have we used Psalms 110 in this book? Remember, 110 is the royal Messiah and the high priest Messiah. It's the dual messiahship. And it's quoted several times in this. The Dead Sea Scroll people, the Qumran people, they even believe there's going to be two messiahs because of these texts like this. Remember in Zechariah where Zerubbabel wears the signet ring of the Messiah, but Joshua, the lineage of the high priest, is also a messianic figure? Both of them are right there. Jesus, remember it back in Hebrews 1? Jesus fulfills all three anointed offices in himself, right? That was chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. 1 through 3, excuse me. He's better prophet, he's king, and he's high priest. Only in Hebrews is Jesus fulfill all three anointed offices. So he sat down. No priest ever sat down. This has got to be royal. First couple of verses. The right hand of the throne of God. Right hand is metaphorical. I do not believe God has a right hand. Please don't. I'm a heretical, but just don't get it heretical in the wrong place. God is an eternal spirit pervasive throughout creation. Is that right? Only Jesus has a physical body. Now, there are places in the Old Testament where God took on physical form, and many of us believe it's the angel of the Lord, maybe even the pre-incarnate Christ in those examples. I'm just torn between, is this going to be physical or is this going to be spiritual? I really don't know as far as heaven, intimacy with God. There are some physical texts. Jesus had a new physical body, and yet a physical body not trapped by time and space. Is that what we're going to have? Well, we're going to be like him, right? In that 1 John 3:2, does not yet appear what we shall be, but when we see him, we'll be like him. I don't know how much physical. I do not expect heaven to be a 1,500 square city. I don't want to live in that stinking city. I want the animals. Are the animals going to be there? Well, Isaiah 11 says they are. I don't know how to put these together. But I will. I don't think there's a gold throne somewhere with an old guy, a young guy sitting on it, and a white bird flying around. Please don't tell me you're that literal. A throne was a way for Oriental people to talk about royalty. God is certainly royalty. This is that. This is that kingship metaphor. How literal should I take it? I tell you the joke. I just like this. I forgot where I heard it. The girl comes home from Sunday school and said, "Mother, mother, God can't move." And the mother said, "What?" Said, "Yes, Jesus is sitting on his right hand." Well, you be careful of being too literal, right? So the throne of God. I put in my notes, you might want to add it to yours, at throne of God. 1 Kings 8:27. You remember what Solomon said when he dedicated the temple? "The universe cannot contain thee, O Lord, much less this house that I have built." See, I'm to the place in my life that I don't believe there is any distinction between secular and sacred. There's no sacred day. There's no sacred building. There's no sacred place. Life is sacred because God's involved in life. The whole universe is his footstool. So these are metaphorical, I think, and not literal. I'm only on verse 3. For consider. I thought this was interesting. That's why I brought it up. You know, the ancients, I guess there's some math people here who know this, but I'm sure new information for me. We put numbers, draw a line at the bottom, and add downward, do we not? The ancients put numbers, drew a line at the top, and added up. So this is literally added up, which means think clearly. Consider. And that's what it is here. Him who endured, now here again, Jesus endured. This word's used over and over. Voluntary, steadfast endurance. I forgot how many times the noun and verb of endure are used in this chapter. It is a bunch. I mean, like upward of 6 or 8. This is the main theme. Jesus endured. Now, you believe in Jews? Hang in there. Quit griping and hang in there, he says to them. Don't shrink back to Moses. Moses is death. We've shown the superiority of the new covenant every step of the way. Don't go back to what can't save. Hang in there. That's what he's saying. And I think the Lord would say that to us. So you will not grow weary and lose heart. Now, both of these, grow weary and lose heart, these are powerful athletic terms. Do you remember watching the, I forgot how many miles this run is in the Olympics, but they run all through the town. Then the last lap is in the stadium, right? And these long distance runners come in after 20, 30 miles, I don't know how long. And they're running around this last 440 yards. And when they cross the goal, they just collapse into somebody's hand. You ever see them do that? Just fall on the track sometime. These are the two words for panting and collapsing after a race. Isn't that a powerful metaphor? Now, the problem is some of us are running so slow, we ain't going to collapse and pant anywhere. There's an intensity and an urgency about who we are and why we're here. You've not yet resisted the point of death. Let's go back to 10:32, where it says they had been persecuted. Some of their property had been confiscated, but they had not died. They had not moved into the church. The church is dying. These folks were still in the synagogue, I think. In your striving against sin, it's this word striving, we get the English word agony from this. Another athletic metaphor, strong athletic metaphors through here. Verse 5, have you forgotten? Now, this is perfect middle. Middle voice emphasizes the subject. Perfect means something happened in the past with abiding results. Now, here are the two possibilities. If we take the tense, the perfect tense, they had completely forgot. If we take the voice, the middle voice, they deliberately forgot. I don't know about, you know, college kids, but sometimes their view is, "Jesus, I'll be back in an hour and a half. I'll catch you here later," right? No. Sometimes there's a purposeful forgetting of the will of God for our life because our own agenda gets in. And then we have a quote from the Septuagint of Proverbs 3:11-12. It's going to be the next several verses. Do not regard lightly. We're moving from the athletic metaphor to the parental metaphor. Do not regard lightly, nor faint when you are reproved by him. It took most of us to get grown to realize that our father was not mad at us when he disciplined us. Because we became a parent. And suddenly now what's dangerous for our children will do anything to stop them. Anything. But discipline is not pleasant for the person. But again, the fact that God disciplines us says that we are his children. And this text goes far to say, if you are not disciplined by the Lord, you're not one of his children. Now what we do, because we're fallen, because we don't understand, we take the discipline of the Lord as a lack of his love. Look what God did to me. God is allowing us to come to situations for us to exercise our faith grow our trust, exhibit our faithfulness to Him, and we're taking those opportunities that He's mad at us. It's a whole new way of looking at life. If circumstances are your only key to happiness, they can be taken any moment. If biblical promises are your key to happiness, no circumstance can take it away. How many good, godly Christians have I gone to their home as a pastor and they look at me and say, why me? Why this? Why now? And the answer is, why not? Is there something special about you? You shouldn't get cancer. You shouldn't get the divorce. Your business shouldn't fail. You shouldn't have a wreck. What? Why do you think it shouldn't happen to you? Well, because if you're a Christian, you ought to have all good stuff. You've been listening to those stinking health, wealth, and prosperity sermons on television. Notice again, he scourges every son whom he receives. I put a little note in my, I hope you'll follow this. Let me just read this. It is so important. Jesus has called us sons several times, while the Old Testament characters back in chapter 11 are called servants. We're called sons. They're called servants. Now New Testament believers are called sons. Verse 7 and 8. Fathers discipline sons. One, for the father's purpose. Number two, for the son's benefit. And number three, for the benefit of the whole family. I've got to start looking at my life through those lenses. Nothing just happens to God's children. Hannah Smith, The Christian Secret of a Happy Life. That's a great book. The Christian Secret. I love when she says, faith does not know that it has wings until it's knocked off its feet. We're griping because of this and that, and it's the very thing God's using to make us trust Him more, develop our faith, move us into Christ-likeness, and we're just like a bunch of little babies screaming and crying because we don't like it. All of us. All of us. All of us do that. Now, notice endure again in verse 7. I would say untested faith may be sincere, but it's never strong. God will test every Christian. Every Christian is tested. Every Christian. It'll be in the area of priority. This dealing with us as sons, I've wondered if this goes back to Deuteronomy 8:5. You can look at that letter. Or if it goes back to Hosea 11:1-4, for the metaphor of God as parent. I think that's a really good a biblical metaphor to understand. Verse 8, if, this first class conditional, assumed to be true, all of God's children have experienced discipline. That's a perfect tense. That's just the way life is. Verse 10, but when fathers discipline us, it didn't seem good. We didn't like it, but our Heavenly Father does it, that we can share in His holiness. Now, I got a few more verses I want to give you because this is a theme that for whatever reason I have been hitting in this church a whole lot more than I normally do. I don't understand that, but I hope you brought your pencil because at verse 12, 10, I want to give you some more. Is it true that God's purpose for every believer is Christ-likeness, holiness? That's the question. Now, hear the text. Would you add Matthew 5, 48? Would you add 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18? 2 Corinthians 7, 1. Would you add Ephesians 4, 13? Would you add 1 Thessalonians 3, 13? 1 Thessalonians 4, 3 and 7. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 3 and 7. And 1 Peter 1, 15. Now, this is one of those paradoxical truths again. And I think once you see the Bible does this, then the proof text method will not satisfy you anymore. If I ask you the question, am I holy when I'm justified? Am I sanctified when I'm justified? Or am I sanctified by living for God? And the answer is yes. The minute we trust Christ, we're justified, which means His righteousness is imputed to our account. Positionally, we are holy in Him without fault or error. That's a positional statement. His robes are put around our shoulders. That's positional sanctification. Then we're called to be holy as our Father in heaven is holy. That's a call to experiential sanctification. So we are holy and we're called to holiness. And I have fussed because I think Baptists tend to preach an easy believism, which is pray this prayer. Friends, I want to say it again. The prayer starts the deal. It doesn't finish the deal. It's the beginning of the walk, not the end. We are called to purposeful, godly, Christ-like, daily, intentional, sacrificial Christian service. We were saved to serve, not saved to get. This is not a message that's very popular, but it is most definitely a New Testament message. In just two more verses, I see the time. I got 4 minutes, looks like. By the way, there's a mistake at 12:12. If you read this, this sounds to me, I just got through of Isaiah. This sounds like Isaiah 35 to me. But Isaiah 35 only has 10 verses in it, so it can't be 3 through 20. It's got to be 3 through 10. And I was going to read just a little of that because these people are steeped in the Old Testament. That's why a little phrase here and there brought a huge amount of Old Testament illusions and emphasis to these first century Jewish folks. Listen to Isaiah 35. I'm just going to read a couple of verses. Encourage the exhausted, strengthen the feeble. Say to those with a palpitating heart, take courage, fear not, behold, your God will come with vengeance, and recompense of our God will come, and he will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf will be unstopped, the lame will leap like a deer, the tongue of the dumb will shout for joy, waters will break forth in the wilderness. Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak. You know what bothers me is that Christianity is the only army I know that shoots its own wounded. We don't come up beside somebody to put our arms around them when they're hurt. We come up beside them to slit their throat, to make ourselves look better at their expense. We must find the weak and purposefully, intentionally, regularly move in to act on their behalf. And when we don't, we're far more American than we are New Testament Christians. No, it's you. And I'm not talking about your neighbor. Don't tell me you enjoyed this. You really preach to the young people. They're not here. Well, one. I'm after you. If you see, particularly among the fellowship, hurting, lonely, depressed, needy, don't be calling some stinking committee. Do something. Oh, well, I come to church regularly. Great. So attendance is what this is all about, huh? No, my friends. If Jesus took time to minister to all those he came across, how do you get away from it? Because we've turned Christianity into a decision instead of into a discipleship. We've turned it into a building instead of into sacrificial living. We just muddied the water here. Make straight paths for your feet. This word straight paths, as you know, this is a play on the word righteousness, this straight edge. And I think I'm going to quit there. But I have a minute or two. I'd like to take your comments because I say to Peggy, I just am doing everything to stir those brothers and sisters up. And they're saying to me, I really enjoyed that. What is it? Are you crazy? Well, you have a hearing aid battery gone dumb? You can't enjoy this. I'm just beating you around the head and shoulders. I'm trying to get you out of New Testament Baptist tradition and into radical New Testament call to holiness. How do I do that? I don't spit or chew. You're going to go to hell if that's all you got. Well, I never say that word. Oh, great. I don't go to R-rated movies. Oh, you'll make heaven for sure then. What kind of nitpicking, squirrely ethics do we have? But we don't mind talking about our brother or sister behind their back. We don't mind tearing up the church of God over some personal preference. Where's the real issue in ethics here? The call is not to pray a prayer. The call is to daily, selfless, Christ-like living. I'm not over it.